A little hidden history, a little pedagogy, a lot of ways we can improve our teaching and mindset so that our history and social studies classrooms tell a more complete, diverse human story. I'm Cheryl Ann Amendola, and this is the Teaching History Her Way podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Teaching History Her Way podcast. My name is Cheryl Ann Amendola, and I am your host. I am so happy that you are here. If you are a new listener, welcome. You are in for a treat today. And if you are a returning listener, welcome back. You're also in for a treat today. Everybody gets a treat today. I'm really, really excited about today's episode. And I just recognize that I say that I'm excited about every episode, and I don't want anybody to think that I'm disingenuous. I really am excited about everybody that I talk to. I'm really excited about today's episode because I don't know about you. I live in an area of the Northeast where there are a lot of old graveyards and old cemeteries. And there is a difference, by the way. And I've always been very curious about the stones that are in them, who is buried there. How can I use this for my classroom? Because kids are really into it. And in particular, there are two cemeteries near my home within 20 minutes of one another that I know have Revolutionary soldiers buried in them, but I just don't know what to do with that information. Today, I have Haley on my show, who is going to help us figure out what to do with those really cool graveyards and cemeteries that are around. So everyone, could you please welcome Haley Atori? She has been a history teacher in the North Central Massachusetts area for the past 11 years, where she teaches United States history to high school students. I met Haley at the George Washington Teachers Institute. She is awesome. She has a master's in the art of teaching history and a bachelor of arts in history and secondary education. Haley participates in lots of professional development opportunities, most recently as a Women in the American Story ambassador through the New York Historical Society. Additionally, she is a National Geographic certified educator. Prior to her teaching career, she worked as a National Park Ranger and a historical reenactor specializing in the Salem witch trials. She is also a member of the Association for Gravestone Studies. In her spare time, she loves visiting museums and parks with her family, and she runs a gravestone Instagram account where she features mostly colonial and federal period gravestones she photographs and researches. She currently lives in New Hampshire with her amazing and supportive husband and young son. And if you want to find Haley on Instagram, her Instagram account is Hales_stones. Welcome, Haley.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. I have been following your account since I met you. I guess it's almost 2 years ago now.
Yeah.
And it is fascinating. And I've always wondered how it works. How do you know what you know? What do you do with it? So again, not disingenuous, very, very excited to have you here. How did you discover that gravestones were a vehicle that you use to teach, or that you can use to teach?
Well, it was actually one of those things that as a teacher, you're handed. In my first year of teaching, the teacher that had a common planning prep with me gave me a worksheet for the local cemetery and said they do a visit every year. I had never gone to the cemetery before and had to map quest the directions. The students had no idea I needed directions to get there. We used the worksheet that the other teacher gave me, and it turned out to be an amazing lesson. But at the end of the school year, I assessed what went well, what needed to improve before the next school year, and I decided to do more research. I had always loved gravestones and old cemeteries, but doing the research really solidified it for me. I became super interested in the cemeteries closest to our school and started to notice other cemeteries more when I was in my car. I started to stop at a bunch of cemeteries that looked interesting and just started to build up my interest by reading about the stones after I found them. Then I realized that gravestones tell a really unique story about the people who lived in the past, and I felt it was a great way to teach students about history, so I started to use them in a variety of lessons.
What did that original worksheet look like? What did it ask students to do?
It was like, what is the name of the person on this stone? What are the imagery on this stone? What year did they die? Is there any other information that you can glean from the stone? Is their job on there? Were they married? Those types of things. It was just a very simple worksheet.
So what did you end up doing with it after your reflection?
So I still use it, honestly, to this day, but I just tell them a little bit more ahead of time. I prepare them for what they're about to see, what each symbol means, that sort of thing.
That is so cool. I would have loved to have been in your class. I want to be in your class now. And I am not even lying. I'm thinking about a cemetery in Pequannock, New Jersey right now as my case study after this interview to go out and visit.
Yeah, definitely.
I do have a question about reverence, though, because I remember being in college and there was a cemetery across the street from the university that the art students always wanted to go in to draw a lot of the headstones, never to take the markings from them. So like they didn't do grave rubbings, which I know can damage the gravestone, but they just wanted to draw them because the art on them was so incredible. What do you say to your students about reverence and respect for the dead? Because we were never allowed in there for that reason.
Yeah. So I think that's where, you know, taking students to cemeteries is really important. Before we go to a cemetery, I think preparation is really key. You need to be very explicit with your instructions, but you also have to give your students a level of trust. Before we go to the cemetery, particularly in my Early America class, I like to show them the motifs that they will encounter and what time period they correspond with, the local carvers, the oldest stone, etc. But I also explicitly share how I want them to behave. I begin by showing students on a map exactly where they are going, so there are no surprises. I explain that the one I take them to, it's still an active cemetery, so that they might actually encounter grieving people. I tell them they shouldn't bring their cell phones, they shouldn't be playing loud music, but I also explain that if you're going to visit a loved one and you want to play a song that was special to you and that loved one, you can. It's just different when you take them for a field trip versus going for a funeral or for remembering them. I tell them they can't run, they can't yell at each other. But there are also times where that is okay. I definitely have a philosophy that cemeteries are meant to be visited and also really enjoyed. Because, you know, when I'm buried one day, I won't mind if someone uses the cemetery I'm at to go for a jog, to see the nature around, to look at the stones, to see the names. But there's definitely an element of you need to be respectful when you're doing that too.
Gotcha. I was curious about that as well. All right. So how do you choose your cemeteries that you use for either your students, whether that's proximity or whatever, or you use for your Instagram account? And how much research is done before you go as opposed to after you find the stones that you think are interesting?
All right. So these are great questions. My answer is it depends. When I first got interested in using gravestones in my class, it was based on what I already knew and what I had access to. For example, the cemeteries closest to where I teach have gravestones from the 1700s. They are also still active cemeteries. It was great finding stories from the local community that my students could relate to because they lived in the same area. For example, John Adams has a cousin who lived in the town I teach and worked as a minister there. His name was Zabdiel Adams, and he's buried in town with a very interesting gravestone. Correspondence exists between the two men that mention the American Revolution. I think Zabdiel is probably being egged on by members of his community to get insider information because he mentions feeling like no news comes to this small farming community and is clearly hoping John Adams gives him a little bit of insight. And that small town feeling is still very relevant to my students. but it also is a way of making sure the students understand and relate to the American Revolution. And as I have really made finding graves and cemeteries a hobby, some of the cemeteries are researched beforehand, and some are honestly researched after I drive by them. A resource that I use that all teachers can access is the digital Farber collection through the American Antiquarian Society online. So according to their website, the Farber Gravestone Collection is an unusual resource. It contains over 13,500 images documenting the sculpture on more than 9,000 gravestones, most of which were made prior to 1800. And most of them are from the northeastern part of the United States. This collection was curated by the late Daniel Farber of Worcester, Massachusetts, and his wife, Jessie Lai Farber. They were responsible for the largest portion of the collection. And the online version of the Farber Gravestone Collection is sponsored by the American Antiquarian Society. And they were created by David Rumsey and Cartography Associates for the online version. I love this website because it explains where the grave is located, the year it was carved, the name of the deceased, and sometimes it tells you more, like how much it cost, who the carver was, even the patterns and motifs that you see on the stone. But another resource that I think is even more accessible and includes so many gravestones is findagrave.com. It is a collaborative collection, meaning people who aren't paid to collect these photos, and they post information about the deceased. And I think it is great for pre and post visits to a cemetery. I use it an awful lot to find cemeteries if I see something interesting on like the Farber collection, just to find the address for this gravestone. And I also find a lot of stones just from driving around. I have a bumper sticker on my car that says this car breaks for old graveyards. And yeah, I like to think it's like a caution sign for cars following me, because I will put my blinker on and come to a stop so fast when I stumble on a cemetery. And an example of finding interesting stones randomly was when I visited a cemetery in Princeton, Mass. I was on a hike and I knew that there was an old cemetery up on the mountain road. And so we stopped there and I start looking around, and there were three stones of enslaved individuals. The stones feature only their first names, Flova, Nero, and Thomas. It says that they were servants to the Honorable Moses Gill, when in reality, he enslaved them. This was a rural community back in the late 18th century, and it's uncommon to see gravestones of enslaved people anywhere in Massachusetts, never mind a small community like Princeton. But it tells us that even in areas that we think were unlikely for slavery, it existed, and that is what gravestones can tell us. I had not heard of Moses Gill before I found these stones, so I was shocked to find out he was Lieutenant Governor of Massachusetts, then acting governor after the death of Increase Sumner, and he served as judge and chief justice in the Worcester County Court of Common Pleas. So it was, you know, with all of that information, it was even more shocking to find out that he was an enslaver, because he was, quote unquote, a patriot who interpreted the Constitution. But that's what gravestones can uncover. And it's not always good what you uncover, but it's very much worth learning. And I found that out just by driving and stopping by.
That is incredible. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, for so many reasons. One, you're in Massachusetts. You don't really think about enslavement in Massachusetts in the late 18th century. You just don't. Yep. And also, you found it on the side of the road. You noted that there were markers for enslaved people, which is not very common really anywhere.
Yep.
And I'm also thinking about that local history connection and what you said earlier about students really being connected to the history that they're learning. it doesn't get much more local than the story of the guy who lived three doors down from where your property is 200 or 300 years ago, who is now buried in town. What was he doing at the time that all of these incredibly textbook famous people were doing their thing?
Yeah.
Wow. That is amazing.
Yeah.
So you talked about the Digital Farber collection and how that helped you learn about motifs and helped you learn about ways to tell who was where and what the art meant on the stone. Can you tell us a little bit more about the stones that you have uncovered in the years that you've been doing this? Maybe about some of the patterns that depict the time period or what some of those patterns tell us. Are there any famous makers?
Oh, yes. So I count this as a hobby. So what I am most interested in is colonial and federal period stones. So I can tell you a little bit about those, particularly the ones in New England. So there are patterns that do emerge. The earliest stones have what is called death's winged face. It is a very morbid visual and looks about as gruesome as it sounds. Imagine a skeleton skull with some wings attached. That image will be paired with equally as morbid language, such as "here lies the body of," or "the mortal remains of." You might even see skull and crossbones, coffins, hourglasses on these earlier stones. Then as time goes on, you will see plain images of a face with wings called a soul effigy or winged cherubs, basically angel-like faces with wings. These never really replaced Deathwing's face, but were used at the same time. In the 18th century, you might see a portrait stone, which was supposed to represent the deceased, but it actually never really looked like the person it was meant to represent. Toward the end of the 18th century and into the 19th century, relationships with death start to change. So the imagery actually softens. You start to see willow trees and urns. These are classical death motifs from ancient Greece and Rome. You will see willow and urns used on the typical gravestones that were used in the prior decades, but you also see a turn to grander monuments, such as obelisks and columns. Language changed on these stones as well. Instead of "here lies ye body of," you have "in memory of." And there are so many famous gravestone carvers out there. I am very familiar with two workshops, but I've come across many carvers overall. One way to find out who carved a particular stone is to check the Farber collection. The collection has checked and researched old probate records and wills to find for certain which carver or workshop is associated with certain stones. And once you have spent time with these stones, with these particular carvers, you start being able to recognize who is who. I want to start by highlighting one of my favorite carvers, John Dwight. He had a workshop in Shirley, Massachusetts. So most of his stones are seen in the north central area of Massachusetts. But his stones were bought by people all over. And you can find his stones as east as Boston, and as north as Vermont. His stones, especially his early ones, have a very distinct and unusual design. Historians and gravestone enthusiasts, they call them Dwight's sprouts. These sprouts look like sprouted plants and are very easy to distinguish. Also, his heads look like they're sort of Medusa-esque, so they're very easy to spot. Another group of carvers that I encounter a lot are the Park Family Carvers of Groton, Massachusetts. They had several members and generations of carvers that used to carve stones for a lot of New England, particularly around their hometown of Groton and into Boston. Their stones are typically ornate and include a lot of writing. And most recently, I have started to research and read a lot about the Taunton River Basin carvers, which have a very unique characteristic, such as a sun with a face. And I don't want to say for sure, because I'm still newly in my research, I can't tell if the sun is setting, which I believe it is, or if it's rising, but I'll have to do more research. I'm going to assume it's setting, but I didn't want to say for sure. And I read a book about those stones. It's called In Death Remembered, 18th Century Gravestone Carvers of the Taunton River Basin by Vincent F. Luddy. There are a lot of other stone carvers that, I mean, we could go on and on all day. But for anyone who wants to look them up, here is a list of some interesting, well-known carvers in the New England area. William Mumford Shop in Boston's North End, the Foster Family Workshop in Dorchester, Henry Christian Geyer in Boston, Caleb Lamson in Charlestown, the Pratt Family in Abington, Barney Leonard in Bridgewater, David Lincoln in Norton, the Soul Workshop of Southeastern Massachusetts, James New in Attleboro, the Stevens Family of Newport, Rhode Island, John Bull of Newport, Rhode Island, and just to name a few.
Wow. You know, I pass by cemeteries and graveyards all the time. And I mean, I guess most of the stones that I'm seeing are newer, with the exception of the ones that I told you I was all excited about before, where they're machine made. It's a heart or something from the 1980s and the 1990s when I started going to funerals as a kid. And I never thought about the kind of symbolism and how that symbolism changes over time. And I think I'm going to keep a closer eye out next time I'm visiting, even for the more modern ones, because the way that we see death really does change over the course of time, whether it's in our own lives as we get older, or whether it's over the course, whether it's societal over the course of a few generations.
Definitely.
So I have another unscripted question for you.
Sure.
And I mean, just going through your Instagram, I saw some of the suns that you referred to. I saw Death's Winged Face and Winged Cherubs. Just so my audience knows, as Haley is going through these, I'm going through her account because it is so fascinating. I explained to Haley, I'm not like texting my friends or doing anything that's disrespectful. I'm really just taking a look at her account because I wanted to see what she has. And I guess my next question is, what is the most unusual gravestone you have encountered?
Wow, that is a very interesting question. I can't really narrow it down to one, but off the top of my head, I am thinking of one stone in Northborough, Massachusetts. It is of a rabbi, and he was living here, and he worked at Harvard University for 38 years, from 1722 to 1760. And it is a William Park of Groton design. It's in the Farber collection. And it's of Judah Monis. And the stone on the front is sort of 3D. The skull and crossbones are, I guess, I don't know, they pop out at you. And there's a lot of information here. It talks about how he was born Jewish, but it says on his stone, he embraced the Christian faith and was publicly baptized at Cambridge. And it's just really unusual and different. It was, according to findagrave.com, America's first Hebrew instructor. And he was one of the earliest Jewish converts to Christianity in the United States. And in 1735, he published the first Hebrew grammar textbook in North America. So just a really unique stone and life.
And another really good example that you just gave us of what we can learn just by stopping to look.
Exactly.
So before we finish up for today, can you give us an example, or another example, I should say, of how we can use either photographs of gravestones, because I realize that not everybody can get out to a cemetery or a graveyard, or going to the cemetery purposefully in our classrooms?
Sure. There are so many ways to incorporate gravestones as a primary source. First of all, they're free, whether it's a visit.
That's right.
Teachers love free, right? Whether it's a visit to a cemetery or through the Farber Collection or findagrave.com, they make a great addition to any lesson that you already have created. For example, I am also a Women in the American Story ambassador. And yes, I use and highly recommend these resources for your classroom. They have life stories. And one of the life stories that I use can be supplemented by a gravestone, and that is the story of Elizabeth Mumbet Freeman. I do an activity called Numbered Heads Together, and I make a slideshow with the questions based on the life story, but I interweave the answer slides with primary sources, and I spend a portion of the lesson on her grave. Her grave is in what is called the Sedgwick Pie, a unique circular formation of graves from the Sedgwick family. She is buried with the family who ended up helping her and hiring her during and after her trial challenging the Massachusetts state constitution for her freedom. She was an enslaved woman. And to read her gravestone gives a great overview of her amazing life. So it says, she was born a slave and remained a slave for nearly 30 years. She could neither read nor write, yet in her own sphere, she had no superior nor equal. She neither wasted time nor property. She never violated a trust nor failed to perform a duty. In every situation of domestic trial, she was the most efficient helper and the tenderest friend. Good mother, farewell. This gravestone reinforces students' understanding after reading the life story from WAMS, or Women in the American Stories curriculum. But it also tells us how well respected she was within that community, that she was given a place in that family cemetery. And this is a time when Black and white people were typically segregated in cemeteries, if a Black person got a gravestone at all. And so it's really cool to see her stone there, and it just reinforces that lesson and her legacy. One of my favorite lessons I do in my Early America class is a case study on three enslaved women that they, like what they did when they were enslaved, what they did to emancipate themselves, and then what they did after they weren't enslaved. And so, of course, I focus on Elizabeth Freeman as a review, Phyllis Wheatley and her poetry, and then another person, Lucy Terry Prince. And I found out about who she was by a gravestone, but it wasn't her gravestone. It was actually a gravestone I found in Deerfield, Massachusetts, and it was the gravestone of Samuel Allen. On his grave, it mentioned he was killed by a Native American, so I obviously wanted to do research on it. While I was researching, I found out that there was a ballad poem about his death. It was called Bar's Fight. Bars being another name for meadow. And what really caught my attention was that this was originally an oral poem created by Lucy Terry Prince, who was a once enslaved woman who lived in the area. I came to find out that this is the first poem attributed to a Black woman from early America, and most likely the earliest piece of literature that we know of by an African American. It was eventually published in print in 1855, so that was over 100 years after it was first created. In the past decade or so, more has been uncovered by researchers about Lucy Terry Prince, and it is really exciting to see more scholarship emerge about her. But I never would have known who she was if it weren't for finding a gravestone that mentioned the event she ended up commemorating. So I love sharing her story with my students. And then as for bringing your class to a cemetery field trip, like I said before, the key is all in the preparation. You need to be very explicit with your instructions. I go over everything that they're going to see, the behavior that I expect. And I try to, like I said earlier, try to explain what is appropriate during a field trip versus what it's like to go to a funeral or to grieve someone that they love at a cemetery. I think this creates a really great opportunity for students to engage with the really hard topic of death and dying in a safe place with a lot of preparation. They are going for a field trip and getting exposure that cemeteries are sad, but they aren't scary. And I show them how to behave so that when the time comes that they need to go for a loss in their life, they have already had the experience of going in a neutral time in their life. Additionally, because when I take them, it's one of the town's active cemeteries, I have students whose parents, grandparents, relatives, neighbors, friends, they're buried there. Sometimes students share their loved one's story with me or their friends, but it helps open up hard conversations between me and the students. So I think there's also a lot of like social emotional learning that is happening when you do these types of activities.
Haley, this was a really awesome episode and I absolutely will be following up with you because I want to tell you how it went. I want you to come back and tell us more. But in the meantime, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And friends in the audience, thank you for visiting me. And if you want to check Haley out on Instagram one more time, it's Hales_stones. And friends, if you are interested in getting in touch with me, you can find me at teachinghistoryherway.com. That's my website. Or you can find me on Twitter at History Her Way, or on Instagram at Teaching History Her Way, or on Facebook, Teaching History Her Way also. I hope you noticed the pattern. Have a lovely and wonderful day, friends out there in audience land, and I will chat with you next time.